These thousand roads of the earth, in the air, and on the waters, these machines, these engines, these philosophies, these constitutions and codes, they are his works which are not necessarily good as are those of God, but which can become so. Whatever man accomplishes, he does not accomplish alone. Just as he needs his wife to propagate the race and perfect the number of the elect, so too does he need her to offer on the altar of the planet this gigantic sacrifice. For, without her, he would be nothing other than a succession of meaningless gestures. We have all met men who have become mere puppets and seem to have lost their soul someplace and cannot recover it. Whoever wishes to accomplish a work that is fruitful must have in him a large measure of vision, patience and prayer. Such is the role of her who has given herself and cannot take back what she has given. If she has given inner meaning to her husband, if she is, as it were, his soul, he gives her meaning within the framework of the universe, and she thus becomes associated with all of his actions. What was not given her to do as woman, her husband can do, not in her place, but with her, by her and through her. For the gift of man cannot be other than his work, while the gift of woman is what is within her and indeed what is deepest within her. Certain imprudent people may well scorn these laws that govern man and wife, but society must respect them at the risk of falling into perfect anarchy. One is astonished to find society falling prey to the error that conjugal love, however reciprocal it may be, is exactly the same both in husband and wife. It is the wife, at once active and contemplative, Martha and Mary, but active within a closed circle, who has chosen the better part. The husband owes whatever honor he has to his wife, but it is his role, and not hers, to sit among the chiefs of his people before the gates of the city. It is thus that the inspired author has described the valiant woman. It is also a conjugal parable that is recounted in the Gospels about the wise and foolish virgins who awaited the spouse not knowing the day or the hour when he would return. Conjugal love differs from all other love precisely in that it is subject to these imprescriptible laws. Daily routine is its lot, a routine that is sometimes indigent and sometimes painful, but which never excludes either self-communion or enchantment. Here each one is in his place, and it is because each has accepted this place once and for all that happiness, as strong and humble as a living plant, comes upon them. The ambition of unhappy lovers is to wish to avoid this routine by breaking through the barriers of time. Christian lovers, on the other hand, have met at some moment in their lives, and it was a prophetic moment in which the whole unknown future until death unwound before their eyes. They accepted it all in one solemn moment with their eyes shut. They do not dream of prolonging their ecstasy in an impossible immobility, but they make it last through the years like a flame that warms but is never extinguished. In the intimate moments of their married life, they never fail to see each other with a joy that is ever new. Not that their appearance does not change, but through all of these changes, something strangely immutable remains. Something undecipherable which God bestowed upon them when He created them. When I feel lost in the entanglement of exterior tasks, I have only to turn again to my wife to find myself. For what she loves in me above all is not the works upon which other men judge me, rather it is a mysterious source which I cannot grasp and which she guards in her heart like a buried treasure. Mary, we read in the Gospel, pondered all of these things in her heart. As for her, she is, once and for all, totally forgotten and lost in me. So much so in fact that I must see her through myself in order that she can know of what she is made. We are thus like two mirrors reflecting each other. All of this, I must add in terminating, is not given on our wedding day. It must be built up in great patience, and that is why time is altogether indispensable for the growth and development of a Christian marriage. It is, furthermore, never terminated, and death interrupts our work without really completing it. Our own strength is indeed far too deficient, and only the grace of marriage enables this bond at once spiritual and carnal to germinate into the inexhaustible fruits of unity. Perfect marriages have no other history than that of happy people, and for the same reasons. It is the secret of the king which must not be revealed. But it suffices to know that it exists, that souls of good will set out in its pursuit, and we can assure them that they would not seek it had they not already found it. Chapter EA. Unity in Marriage. Interceding with his Father, Christ implored him that men be one even as the Trinity is one. Unity then would be absolute perfection, the culminating point of all the perfections that are proposed to us, unity of creatures among themselves and of their community with the Creator. It seems that an image of this perfect conjunction is recognizable in the conjugal bond, the most binding and the most unifying that we can conceive. It is an image of unity, a call to unity, a pressing invitation of God to men to be one with themselves and with Him, to let their fraternal love fuse with divine love, to be admitted one day to the fullness of supreme unity. It has been said that unity is a divine dream and union a human dream. In reality, all human dreams are the first faltering steps, humbly conscious of their limits, of a divine aspiration, a tentative beginning, a departure in the right direction. When we consider our world, the unity Christ prayed for seems to be of the celestial order. But it implies immediate consequences that are of the earth. No state of life appears more marked with their imprint than marriage. For no state of life recalls so insistently to man closed in upon himself by sin that, saved by Christ, he must, day after day, break through the barrier of his ego by means of love of others to begin his pilgrimage towards the liberation that will one day mark his entry into the unity of life. Called by God to eternal life, to the perfection of unity, we are therefore called as of now to the perfection of union which leads to it. There is no discontinuity between the two, and to realize union is already to answer, within our present limits, his call to unity. It is in this perspective that conjugal union appears so magnificent, so pleasing to God, and truly, the seed of eternity. The first words of the introit of the nuptial mass are, "May the God of Israel unite you." This union is perfectly and totally orientated towards God. What is proposed here is a union of love founded on Him and glorifying Him by what it is and what it accomplishes. Love is the one force in the world most capable of uniting two persons, and added to it are the powerful forces of the sacrament which sustain and fortify it. Yet in every home contrary elements work against both love and grace. That is why everything in our personalities and in our lives must fall under the marriage contract. Then the disintegrating powers can be resisted with the growing strength of a living we which gradually replaces two eyes, so much weaker against temptations. Nevertheless, the weak can also know temptations. They have as sources the egoism of two people who refuse to open themselves to others, the abdication of one of the spouses before the other and his absorption by the other, the dissolution of two personalities into a faint-hearted we. We are not forgetting that it is here a question of a union between two complementary persons, a union far richer than that of two similar persons, since each must fill up what is lacking in the other and not merely duplicate. It is richer and also more difficult. Such a union demands more than an adaption, it demands a harmonization on all levels of masculine and feminine personalities so different and often, in many respects, so conflicting. On all levels, the harmonious accord of two beings and two lives can neglect nothing. It supposes the union of activities, of bodies, of characters, of hearts, of sensibilities, of intelligences and of souls. It is not enough to envisage such a union, to desire it, or to dream imaginatively of its beauty. We should will it and effect it. If so many marriages are not really unions, it is because we expect everything from love and from the sacrament, forgetting that the most abundant graces are helpless without our sincere and active goodwill. What we must wish and effect is the common pooling of our whole being and of our whole life. To refuse to do so is to sin against love, and, in a concrete case, the only justification of such a refusal is that the pooling might go against the will of God. We may as well admit that there are numerous more or less conscious ways of cheating. To try to pool everything in common through an egoistic will of independence is to cheat. To reserve a secret garden to which you have decided that your partner will have no access, and to make no effort to render your whole life communicable, is to cheat. To desire not to live together spiritually, is to cheat. Not to interest yourself in the whole life of the other, inside and outside the home, is to cheat. Not to respect and favor everything that the other holds dear, is to cheat. To no longer need the other, is to cheat. Not to remain oneself, to abdicate one's personality or renounce one's personal life through a false notion of submission or to have peace, is also to cheat, for then we would be giving only a pale reflection of ourselves to the other instead of a life and a richness which would develop and complete him, being no longer anything, we have nothing to give. In what then does union consist? To realize it fully, we must prefer the bond of love in reciprocal dependence, the opening and offering of our life to another, to our personal independence. We must make our partner participate in our whole life and to render it communicable to the other in every possible manner. We must be attentive to the needs of the other. We must apply ourselves together to perfect a common work. This total union is to be realized in spite of the disintegrating forces exerted against it. Their common source is self-love, so contrary to real love, with which original sin has impregnated us and which actual sin in all of its forms aggravates still more. Apathy and routine impede us from actively desiring union. It suggests 1001 bad or insufficient reasons to put off or elude such a change of attitude. Such an effort towards more confidence and frankness. A proud inflexibility then replaces the humble suppleness of the first love which made the heart unattached and rendered it capable of understanding another heart, its thoughts, desires and sentiments, however removed they might be from one's own. And it sometimes happens that certain real conflicts of taste or character seem to set indomitable obstacles in the path of union. Conjugal union must be understood as a conquest to be attempted again and again. For far stronger than the enemy forces, love and grace will come to our rescue. With such allies we have no right to despair. Perhaps the essential quality of that initial love, in virtue of which two people choose one another, determines in part the degree of union that is possible for each marriage to reach. But we must not pretend that we cannot go beyond such limits. When grace is operative, it uses even what appears to obstruct it and responds magnanimously to the humblest of good wills. Briefly, and as a theme of meditation that each couple should study in keeping with the grace accorded it, let us consider this moral and spiritual union in its different aspects. Let us recall here that this union will only be fruitful if each personal life is rich and is continually enriching itself. If the efforts of two personal lives fructify in a common work, and finally if this collaboration reflects back upon the personal life of each, conditioning it and enriching it. Thus the whole sweep of married life is magnificently unified. Union of activities. Evasions are most contrary to such unity. They can range from a personal activity that becomes a manifestation, more or less conscious, of independence, to the absence of any deep communal life. While there is an independence that is harmful to unity, there is another, perhaps exteriorly similar, that is entirely different and aids the development of each personality. This latter appears singularly apt to harmonize the different roles of husband and wife. Can we not say that to renounce all personal initiative under the guise of submitting totally to that of the other, is a kind of devaluation, a loss to our personal life which conditions our common life, and therefore a deception? If a certain kind of independence is good, an absence of interest in our personal activities is not. Our activity is part of ourselves, it conditions very deeply what we are and what we are striving towards. To be disinterested in our activity is tantamount to being disinterested in ourselves.